You're listening to DCFHN for May 18th, 2026. I'm your structurally unsound host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where people who build things argue with people who describe things. Today's full of blueprints that were right all along and a world still catching up. Let's get into it. What does it actually mean to prove that software is secure? Not test it, not audit it. Not hope really hard and patch on Tuesdays. Prove it. Mathematically, formally, the way you prove a theorem. In 1979, a team at SRI International asked that question and built something called PSOS, the Provably Secure Operating System. And the architecture they chose is worth pulling apart, because the core idea has aged remarkably well, while the industry mostly ignored it for decades. PSOS was built on capabilities, not access control lists, not permissions bolted onto a file system after the fact, but capability. Unforgeable tokens that grant specific rights to specific objects. If you hold the capability, you can act. If you don't, you can't. The system doesn't need to check who you are, it checks what you hold. Run this forward. In a capability system, there's no ambient authority. A program can't just reach out and touch whatever the user can touch. It can only access what it's been explicitly handed. Every piece of code operates with minimum privilege by default. Not because some administrator configured it correctly, but because the architecture makes anything else impossible. The engineering elegance here deserves real admiration. So, PSOS was designed as a hierarchy of abstraction layers, each formally verified against the layer below it. The specification language, special. Let them write machine-checkable proofs that each layer correctly implemented its contract. This wasn't hand-waving about security properties. This was actual mathematical correspondence between what the system promised and what the system did. And then the industry collectively shrugged and built Unix derivatives for 40 years. One of the comments on this paper makes a sharp observation. That capability-based architecture might have seemed excessive before the internet, but after it, what else could possibly be appropriate? We've spent decades bolting security onto systems that were never designed for hostile environments. Patching buffer overflows, sandboxing applications inside containers, inside virtual machines, layering defense after defense because the foundation assumes trust that no longer exists. The PSOS team had the right architecture in 1979. Capability-based security, formal verification, minimum authority as a structural property, not a policy choice. The tools exist now to actually build this at scale. Proof assistants are faster, hardware is abundant, and projects like Celpeer4 have shown that formally verified kernels aren't just academic exercises. 47 years later, the blueprints are public. The math checks out, and most of the world is still running on architectures that can't answer the simplest question. Can you prove this is secure? The paper is right there. It always was. Now, if we're talking about building better tools from scratch, let's talk about who's actually doing that with creative software. There's a question bouncing around developer forums that sounds devastating until you actually stress test it. Where are the VibaCoded Photoshops? Where's the VibaCoded Blender? The VibaCoded Compiler? The VibaCoded Operating System? If AI-assisted coding is real, where are the artifacts? The question answers itself, and the answer is more interesting than the gotcha. Building software has always operated on three distinct layers. Layer one is syntax. Typing. Knowing which header file, which import path, which semicolon goes where. Layer 2 is verification. The test harness, the feedback loop. the discipline of rejecting 90 attempts that almost work to ship the one that does. Layer 3 is architecture, deciding what to build at all. Which data model survives contact with 10,000 concurrent users? Which abstraction holds up when requirements shift 6 months from now? AI made layer 1 nearly free. That's genuine. That's measurable. That's happening right now across millions of code bases. But layers 2 and 3, untouched. The gate is exactly where it always was. And this is where it gets worth paying attention to. Because the people doing the accusing and the people doing the building are revealing something about themselves. The builders look at a project like Soul Player and ask about the verification strategy. How was consistency enforced? What's the test coverage? They're operating at the gate. They recognize craft when they see it, regardless of which tools produced the syntax. The accusers can't ask those questions because they were never at the gate. They were at layer 1. And layer 1 was their identity. Pull this thread further, and you find the real irony. The accusation that someone shipped unverified output is itself unverified output. No definition of vibe coded. No test for quality. No falsification criteria. Just a claim shipped fast, never checked. The accusers are vibe coding their criticism. Now here's what matters for anyone who builds things. The tools that lowered the cost of layer 1 are open. Claude is accessible through an API. Local models run on consumer hardware. The verification layer, the architecture layer, those skills compound with practice and they transfer across every tool that comes next. The people investing in layers 2 and 3 right now are building on bedrock. Every wave of abstraction and computing has eliminated someone's layer 1. Assembler replaced hand-code machine instructions. Compilers replaced assembler for most work. Each time, the people at the gate stayed at the gate, and the craft got deeper. The vibe-coded Photoshop isn't missing. It was never the right question. The right question is whether your skills live at the layer that just got automated or the layers that never will. 3 stories in and we're already knee-deep in the good stuff. Next up, ProGenCAD. In Yunnan Center 60 Lees, the ALPAC report nearly killed machine translation funding for a generation. The demos had looked incredible. Feed in Russian, get English. What the committee discovered was that every impressive result had been handpicked, and the systems collapsed on anything outside their narrow training sets. The researchers weren't lying. They were showing what was possible. The gap between possible and useful just happened to be a canyon. GenCAD lands in that canyon with both feet. The pitch is genuinely exciting. Take an image of a 3D object. Generate not just a mesh or a point cloud, but the actual parametric Qwank command sequence. The full program that a geometry kernel can execute to produce a real, editable, manufacturable, solid model. Meshes are dead geometry. A CAD program is alive. You can change a fillet radius, just a hole spacing, sweep a new profile. That distinction matters enormously for anyone who actually makes things. The architecture is ambitious. An autoregressive transformer learning latent representations of CAD sequences, contrastive learning bridging image and CAD latent spaces, a diffusion model generating CAD latents conditioned on images, and a decoder that converts those latents back into parametric commands. 4 stages, each solving a real problem. On paper, this is the pipeline you design if you wanted image to CAD to actually work. The Hacker News comments tell the ALPAC story all over again. Multiple engineers tried to run it. Dependencies broken out of the box. Results that look great on training data and collapse on anything else. Even simple drawings. One commander spent hours and couldn't produce usable output on novel inputs. Another points out that the hard part of CAD was never generating geometry. It's dimensions, tolerances, constraints. The engineering judgment that turns a shape into a part. And yet, the code is published, the weights were available. Someone pointed out that OpenSCAD has enabled code-driven CAD for years. Lulamaz Sikane already write OpenSCAD reasonably well. These threads converge. The parametric representation is the right target. The training data is the bottleneck, and that's a solvable problem. Especially when the research is open, the ARCID report set machine translation back 20 years because the funding dried up and the code stayed locked in labs. GenCAD ships its code to GitHub, where anyone can fork it, fix the dependency hell, expand the training set, and close that canyon between demo and tool. The architecture is sound. The execution isn't there yet. But the difference between a locked-up failure and an open-source failure is that open-source failures are just version 0.1. We talked about tools finding their people. Well, sometimes people push back, and this graduation season, they pushed back loud. Eric Schmidt got booed at the University of Arizona on Sunday. Not once, multiple times, during a commencement speech about artificial intelligence, and he wasn't alone. Several speakers across the country caught the same reaction this graduation season. Former CEO of Google, net worth north of $20 billion, standing at a podium telling 22-year-olds entering the worst white-collar job market in a generation that AI is going to be transformative. The clinical read on this is straightforward. These graduates spent 4 years and six figures preparing for careers that every headline now tells them won't exist. The boos aren't irrational. They're a demand signal. The audience is saying, we understand the technology. We don't trust the people deploying it. And that distinction matters enormously. Run this forward 5 years. The graduates booing today will be 30. AI will be deeper in every workflow, every hiring pipeline, every creative tool. The technology doesn't care about the boos. It compounds regardless. The question is whether those graduates are using it or being used by it. Whether the tools are open enough that a freshly minted English major can build something with them. Or locked behind enterprise contracts that only benefit the companies these speakers represent. One commenter, a high school English teacher's friend, captured something precise. Kids keep hearing it's inevitable. An inevitability without agency is just a fancy word for helplessness. That's the failure here. Not the technology, the framing. When a billionaire tells you disruption is coming, the subtext is, disruption is coming for you and it's coming from me. Of course you boo. The honest version of that speech would sound different. It would say, the same tools that threaten your entry-level job can eliminate the gatekeepers between you and the work you actually want to do. Open source models run on laptops now. The marginal cost of building something is collapsing toward zero. That's not a threat to a 22-year-old with energy and no legacy infrastructure to protect. That's the best possible news. But that's not the speech Schmidt gave, because the honest version requires admitting that the value isn't in controlling the technology. It's in releasing it. The boos will age well. The speeches won't. Moving on. Someone in the comments asked a perfectly reasonable question. Does a crystal formed inside a nuclear explosion really count as naturally forming? Because the scientists describe this new clathrate found in trinitite, the glassy residue from the Mine 4-5 Trinity test. as a structure never seen before in nature. But the thing that made it was, by definition, not nature. It was the Manhattan Project. The deadpan beauty of this distinction is worth sitting with. 81 years ago, humans built the most destructive device in history, detonated it in the New Mexico desert, and accidentally created material science that we still cannot reproduce in a lab. The temperatures exceeded 1500 degrees Celsius. The pressures hit several gigapascals. Enough to turn graphite into diamond. Sand vaporized, mixed with copper sensor wires, and cooled so fast that atoms didn't have time to find their stable arrangements. They just froze mid-panic in decay-like lattices called clathrates. Silicon dodecahedrons and tetrahedrons trapping calcium, copper, and iron atoms inside. One commenter, bless them, got sidetracked by the word tetrahedron. If dodeca means 12, why isn't 14 just tetradeca? The answer involves Greek compound number conventions. But the real point is that we needed a word for a 14-sided cage that only exists because we split an atom in anger. And here's the part that actually matters for anyone who cares about open science. This clathrate was found alongside a quasicrystal, a form of matter once considered theoretically impossible. Made of the same four elements, under the same conditions. The only other natural quasicrystal came from an asteroid collision when the solar system was young. We matched the creative output of planetary-scale violence with a gadget built in a shed in Los Alamos. And the researchers publishing this work, they're at the University of Florence, University of Massachusetts Lowell, Carnegie Mellon. Public institutions. Open literature. The crystallography is in PNAS for anyone to read. Another commenter raised the obvious follow-up. What about the hundreds of other nuclear tests? Why is Trinity special? It's not necessarily. It's just the one we've looked at most carefully. Which means there could be entire libraries of impossible materials scattered across test sites in Nevada and Kazakhstan, and the Pacific sitting in irradiated glass, waiting for someone with a synchrotron and curiosity. The tools exist. The samples exist. The most destructive moment in human history keeps quietly handing us blueprints for things we don't know how to build yet. The unintended consequences have consequences of their own, and those turn out to be pretty interesting. Moving on. The strongest argument for the hard problem of consciousness goes something like this. Every other scientific problem asks how something works. Consciousness asks why there is experience at all. You can map every neuron, trace every signal, build a complete functional model of the brain, and still have no explanation for why it feels like something to see red. That gap isn't a gap in knowledge. It's a gap in kind. Physical descriptions describe function. Experience is not function. Therefore, experience requires something beyond physics. That's the steel man. And Carlo Rovelli, one of the architects of loop quantum gravity, just published a careful dismantling of it in NOEMA. His core move is deceptively simple. Strip away the metaphysics and ask what we're actually claiming. When Chalmers declared the hard problem in 1994, he drew a line between two things. The mechanical processes of the brain and the subjective experience those processes produce. And then he said that line represents a fundamental divide in nature. Experience on one side, physics on the other. Rovelli's response is that this divide isn't a discovery. It's an inheritance. It's the medieval soul dressed in analytical philosophy. Body here, spirit there. Matter and transcendence. We've been running this operating system for 1,000 years. And the hard problem is what happens when you try to formalize it without admitting where it came from. Here's what the first principles analysis actually yields. We cannot fully predict weather 2 weeks out. We cannot cure the flu. We cannot derive the behavior of a bicycle from particle physics, even though we're confident particle physics governs every atom in it. The gap between fundamental laws and emergent phenomena is everywhere in nature. Consciousness sits in that gap. Not because it's supernatural, but because it's extraordinarily complex. The same kind of hard that protein folding is hard. The same kind of hard that turbulence is hard. One commenter mapped over 325 distinct theories of consciousness. 325. Most of them already reject dualism. The philosophical debate Chalmers launched is, in many ways, a rearguard action. Smart people defending a boundary that the actual science has been quietly dissolving for decades. Ravelli isn't saying consciousness is simple, or that we're close to understanding it. He's saying the mystery is a natural mystery, and natural mysteries yield to patient, open inquiry. Not to declarations that some questions are permanently beyond reach. The history of science is a graveyard of hard limits that turned out to be temporary ignorance. Consciousness belongs in the queue, not on a pedestal. Remember earlier when we talked about running your own infrastructure? Well, someone took that literally. I make Molly, or the $80 Android tablet. I once spent 3 weeks trying to get a single GPIO pin working on a board with no documentation. Just me, a logic analyzer, and a lot of educated guessing. That experience is why this project stopped me cold. A developer going by Tech4Bot took an $80 Duji U10 Android tablet, a Rockchip RK3562 with 4 gigs of RAM, and reverse-engineered it into a fully bootable Debian 12 workstation. No bootloader on lock, no vendor docs, no BSP. You write the image to an SD card, slot it in, power on, and you're running Bookworm with touchscreen Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, audio, cameras. Even the NPU for local LLM inference. Pull the card out, it boots back to stock Android like nothing happened. Let me play devil's advocate for a moment. You could argue this is a toy. 4 gigs of RAM, Cortex A53 cores from a generation ago, a 10-inch display. Who needs this when a refurbished ThinkPad exists? But that argument misses what's actually elegant here. The entire driver stack was reconstructed by working backward from Rockchip's open-source Firefly repositories, with Claude and Gemini acting as reverse engineering collaborators. The device tree, the panel driver, the touchscreen firmware, the power management IC integration, all of it built from inference and experimentation. That's not a toy, that's craft. And the architecture is beautiful. Non-destructive dual boot from removable media. Your Android install stays pristine on eMMC. Your Linux environment lives on the SD card. The reversibility is the feature. You're not bricking anything. You're not voiding anything. You're just using hardware you already own in a way the manufacturer never intended but can't prevent. One commenter nailed it. This is what they want from an iPad Pro. Unlock the silicon, let people run real operating systems. Apple won't do it, because control is the product. Meanwhile, an $80 tablet from a brand most people haven't heard of is running a full desktop environment with an app store, Flatpak support, and neural network inference on the NPU. The tools exist. The models help. And when the vendor won't give you documentation, you build it yourself. That's how open source wins. Not by asking permission, but by making permission irrelevant. Now for something completely different. Forget silicon. Pause. Let's talk about actual space. Someone just open sourced 333 hours of astronaut QA footage. 333 hours. That's the number that stopped me. Not the project name, not the interface, not even the fact that it's searchable. 333 hours of astronauts answering questions, indexed and transcribed, and sitting there for anyone to explore. To understand why that matters, think about how a coral reef works. No single polyp builds the reef. Each one deposits a tiny calcium structure, and over years, those deposits accumulate into something massive enough to support an entire ecosystem. That's what this project is. Every school group that got 15 minutes with the International Space Station, every kid who asked about sneezing in space or sleeping in zero gravity, every astronaut who patiently explained orbital mechanics for the 100th time. Each of those interactions was a polyp, individually small. Collectively, they built a reef of human knowledge about living off-world. The developer behind this mentioned, it started with a simple question. What if all the questions kids could ask astronauts had already been asked? Turns out, they mostly have been 333 hours worth. The engineering here deserves attention. They've taken what was scattered across hundreds of downlink sessions and educational events and built a semantic search layer over it. You type a question, and the system finds the moment an astronaut answered something close to it. The transcripts are time-stamped. The video is clipped. And look at what services when you give people a tool like this. One commenter discovered their own question to the ISS might be unique in the entire corpus. Someone else noticed that every question about sneezing in space asks about open air or Newton's third law. But nobody ever asked what happens if you sneeze inside a helmet. 333 hours, and there are still gaps. That's beautiful. It means the reef is still growing. The source material here is public, NASA downlink sessions, educational programs, publicly funded science communication. Someone took that public resource and made it genuinely useful. No paywall, no API key, no institutional gatekeeping. Just a searchable window into what it's actually like to live in space. Built by people who thought the knowledge deserved better than sitting in unlabeled YouTube archives. The coral is there. Now anyone can dive. We talked earlier about building better tools. Well, someone just built a better tool for building tools themselves. Next up. Every compiler that lives long enough on top of LLDM eventually builds its own IR. Someone in the comments pointed that out, and they're right. Even Clang is doing it now. But the interesting question isn't why this keeps happening. It's why we keep being surprised when it does. Jay Wilkerson has been building Jane, a Clojure dialect that compiles natively through LLLMN instead of running on the JVM. And for years, the strategy was reasonable. Generate C++ or LLLMIR. Let LLLM's optimizer do what it does best. Ship the binary. Except, LLMM doesn't know what a var is. It doesn't understand persistent data structures or lazy sequences or any of the polymorphic indirection that makes Clojure feel like Clojure. You hand LLLMN this beautifully abstract language, and it sees opaque pointer calls. It shrugs. It does what it can, which isn't much. The fix is a custom intermediate representation that operates at the level of Clojure's own semantics, higher than LLLM. IR, higher than JBM bytecode, tailored specifically to Jenk. Because when you're not building a general-purpose VM, you don't need general-purpose compromises. The IR knows about VARs, about transients, about the specific shapes of Clodger's runtime. And because it knows, it can optimize in ways LLMN never could. In lining across dynamic dispatch, eliminating boxing, collapsing indirection chains that exist for flexibility but cost you at runtime. One commenter noted, this is a very high bar. Competing with the JVM's optimizer, which has had decades of engineering and billions of dollars behind it. That's true. But here's what's also true. This is one person building a native Clojure compiler. In the open, publishing the IR reference, the benchmarks, the design rationale, asking GitHub sponsors to help cover rent. The JVM is extraordinary engineering. Nobody serious disputes that. But it's also an entire ecosystem where the optimization knowledge lives inside institutional walls, inside corporate engineering teams, inside decades of proprietary GIT heuristics. Jay's doing the work in public, showing exactly how each optimization pass transforms the code, making the compiler itself a teaching tool. Pull this thread and you find the pattern everywhere. General purpose tools get you started. Domain specific knowledge gets you fast. And the only way that knowledge compounds is if someone writes it down where others can read it. The IR reference is in the jank book. The code is on GitHub. The groceries are funded by strangers who think compilers matter. Moving on. K is a language that most programmers have never touched, but many have heard rumors about. Arthur Whitney wrote the original in C, famously dense, famously fast, famously fitting an entire interpreter in a few kilobytes. The aesthetic is ascetic. Single character functions, no redundancy, every byte of source code doing real work. It's the programming equivalent of a haiku written by someone who thinks haikus are too verbose. Now someone has re-implemented K version 3 in C1500 test passing, full verb and adverb coverage, foreign function interface into the .NET ecosystem, built in under 6 months. The comments immediately raise the obvious objection. K's entire identity is minimalism, and C is not minimal. The original K interpreters are legendary for their density. Re-implementing that in a managed language with garbage collection and a virtual machine underneath feels like translating a telegram into a legal brief. But that objection misses what's actually happening here. The value of K was never the small binary size. The value was the computational model. Right-to-left evaluation, implicit iteration over arrays. The entire vector programming paradigm that treats data transformation as composition of primitives. That model doesn't care what runtime sits beneath it. What the .NET runtime gives you is something Whitney's original never prioritized. Portability without pain, memory safety by default, and access to every library in the ecosystem. The author cut the KUI entirely and pointed at WinForms and Unity instead. That's a real architectural decision. Don't rebuild what the platform already solved. The honest admission about technical debt matters too. AI-assisted development got this to beta fast, but left a parser that the author describes as having a moderate probability of choking on complex one-liners. The legacy parser attempted left to right with backtracking, until that collapsed. The replacement works, but carries scar tissue from the migration. 1500 tests, MIT license with Commons Clause, published executables for 3 platforms. 1 person, 6 months. A language most developers will never use, but that shaped how we think about computation. The tools exist. The code is public. That's how it's supposed to work. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for May 18, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI-generated. Scripts by Claude Opus 4.6. Voice by Quen 3TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go make something worth sharing. We'll see you back here tomorrow.